Hello and welcome to Movies and Tea After Hours. I'm your host as always, Edward Jones, and joining me of course is my co-host, Miss Kim Lowe.
Hello.
Tonight we are going to be looking at the Chinese animation, White Snake, which was released way back in 2019, a production from Light Chaser Animation. Light Chaser, if you're not familiar with the name, it's an animation company set up by Gary Wang, who founded the showing website Tudu. Since 2016, have been producing animation in China to promote the Chinese animation market, which has been cited as a rapidly growing market. This is the fourth production that they put out. As I said, it was released way back in 2019 and is based on the Chinese folktale Legend of the White Snake. So, Kim, this is obviously your pick for our After Hours portion of the show. What was it about White Snake that made you want to bring it to the show?
Light Chaser Animation has done a lot so far, and White Snake is one of those Chinese animations that I was very impressed with the first time I watched it. But at the same time, it's also, White Snake is a story that's very popular, especially in like TV adaptation, TV series adaptation when you have Chinese series. So it's a story that I know really well. I don't know if you know it really well, but I know it really well. And the fact that they decided to twist the story around and give White Snake an origin story, a story that took place, you know, before the series or any of the series talks about, is an interesting take. I don't know how true it is to the actual, you know, folklore, because I'm not, you know, I've never really actually read the folklore itself, but I think that it's a very unique take on just how they approach it. And plus the visuals are beautiful, and I love visuals. Like, visuals can make this, you know, make animation so beautiful now. And it's amazing to see that, you know, the leaps and bounds that it's gone in especially in China to, you know, to do this. And I think that taking the approach of using your own folklore and mythologies and adding your own twist and using that to share with the rest of the world, especially the Western world, is a really, you know, is a really good angle.
Definitely so. I mean, obviously, when it comes to animation, I mean, it's obviously dominated by the West, and outside of that, it's obviously Japan with anime. So to see Chinese animation was really interesting, especially because it opens up a whole new wealth of material that can be adapted. A lot of stories and ideas and themes that we've obviously previously not seen animated. And certainly to do Chinese fables such as like Journey to the West and Legend of the White Snake is a really interesting start. I mean, this film also goes by the title of White Snake, The Origin. I'm not familiar with the, as I said, the actual mythos at all, so this was all completely new to me going into it. But the story follows the White Snake demon called Blanca, who loses her memories while being sent to carry out an assassination plot. And ends up having to disguise herself as a human woman and ends up falling in love with a snake hunter. Along the way, reuniting with her green snake demon sister, Verta, with the two sisters having to unite to defeat the big evil of the film. I mean, this is obviously interesting. It's obviously got a period piece, which is going to be a real interesting comparison when you get onto the sequel, Green Snake, which really is not a period piece in the slightest. The animation with this one, I'm in two minds about, because there was moments of this animation where it was like really fantastic, especially with like the movement and the design, and then you would have like the human characters and they seemed a little odd to myself. I just couldn't get on with like the human models in this one. I don't know why. Is there something about the skin tone or just the design? It was sort of like watching a bunch of dolls rather than actual characters.
I don't know. I mean, I don't really have that issue, I guess. I feel like it isn't very, I mean, I don't watch a lot of Chinese animation, period. I mean, I watch mostly movies and TV series. So to me, I thought they were pretty decent. they had a bit of a, you know, big eyes quality to them.
Yeah.
so they kind of felt a bit like Japanese animation. And I think when we get to talking about the sequel, there were some moments where I felt like I was watching, like, some inspirations of Miyazaki. So it kind of, it's really great because it kind of ties into, you know, obviously the season that we just finished. But I didn't really have any issues with this. The only issue I had with this one is that it doesn't really live up as well in repeat viewings. Okay. The first time I watched it, I gave it a 4.5. And I believe as I'm watching it now, I think I went back. I dropped a little bit to like a 4 or something like that. It's just sometimes I think it's not really the human models that I have the issues with, is that I feel like the romance, maybe because I'm getting older, I don't connect with it as much. Because I remember the first time I watched it, I was at a film festival.
Yeah.
And it got me kind of emotional, but, you know, like, you know, in public, you don't get very emotional type of emotional, you know, like watery eyes, you know, like eyes gets a little misty.
Yes.
Everything else I really like. I think that it's just, my issue with it is just, it's just that in like repeat viewings, I still really love the visuals. I think that some of the things are beautiful, like dandelions flying around.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the landscape and the color palette. And it's really, really lovely. It has so much really nice balance and stuff with you know, the action and the romance and the sisterhood and, you know, the spirits and humans and that sort of thing. And it's really, really well balanced for the whole story. But, it, you know, in the end, it is kind of like I said, I've never really heard of this as an origin story, so I don't know where it comes from. But to me, I don't think the human models have any issues. I'm okay with them. I don't usually have issues with that. So it's not like my focus. I don't really look at that unless it's like really, really out of the world. But so I didn't have an issue with it.
Yeah, I totally agree with yourself. I mean, the relationship, you have to excuse me because it is just trying to remember all the names here. The relationship between Blanca and Zhuan. Yeah, I like yourself. It did nothing for me at all. It also was surprising when they have an intimate moment. It's like, oh, this isn't a kids movie. Because it had that real Kingdom Hearts feel to it, where I was like, is this a kid's movie? And then something had happened. It's like, oh no, this is actually supposed to be an adult animation. So it's interesting the animation style that they went for, especially for something that isn't been clearly designed as family viewing. So because it's got a Disney-esque quality to it. And the fact that these characters are very sort of happy-go-lucky, the dog talks, but adds absolutely nothing to the film. He's no Gigi, that's for sure. Where it's like Gigi like adds so much to Kiki's Delivery Service, especially the American dub. This dog is sort of like, I had no idea where the thinking was going with this dog, but the dog's like charming enough when it's not talking, and then they decide to have the dog talk, and it just adds nothing to the film whatsoever.
I think it's like their little attempt to give it a bit more of a childhood charm. Because everything that you have, like, whenever you look at, like, Miyazaki or look at a lot of animation,
yeah,
there's always this, like, character. You know, when you look at Minions or you look at Despicable Me, well, Minions was, you know, their cute element. And then you have, you know, that different, you know, different films have that sort of thing. So I think this was their attempt at it. But then, I mean, when you look at the content of it, obviously they didn't, like, go, like, oh, full, you know, the whole intimate scene was super, you know, detailed. It was kind of like, it happened, you moved behind a pole, and then it ended type of thing, yeah. Right? But that's very Chinese.
It
like,
is.
Even in series, it's like that. So I'm pretty used to it, like, because there are certain rules that they have to abide by, so... I understand, like, I don't have an issue with it, but, you know, it's just their relationship is, I think that as you watch it more, you feel like it's a bit rushed because the first film is only an hour and 40 minutes, which is a very decent runtime, and they had to cram in all of the action and all of the, and all the romance and all of the sisterhood and both sides. It was a lot of stuff to cram into it. So they didn't really have the time to, like, develop the story and really build it for the relationship, like, the romance itself. So I feel like the connection kind of loses. I don't know why the first time I watched it, I was so, like, enthralled. I feel like it's, like, maybe film festival fever. I have that sometimes, especially, like, with something that I really, really like. Like, I get very carried away when I'm at a film festival. But when I sit back at home, it's not the same thing, right? You have things going on, and you're not really as focused.
Yeah.
And then you kind of, like... you don't get as into it as you normally would. I just feel like maybe it's just I got older and the film just didn't carry what I liked. Like my, because my, like I know, I've noticed that recently is that my, the romance I like has changed. Like I still like, you know, a lot of things that I did. It hasn't changed a lot, but there are certain elements like the depth of the romance itself will change how connected I feel to it. And I think that that's what happened here is that a few years went by and I've kind of grown up. You know, I became a mom now, so it's, you know, the romance changed that I like. So I don't know. I mean, it's just that.
I mean, even if it's one even gets himself turned into a demon so that he can obviously be with Blanca. And it's so hard to not think, confuse the two, because obviously Blanca is the white snake, but in your mind you played so much Street Fighter that you say here Blanca and you assume it's the green snake, but it's not.
well, no, I mean, I think that, you know, when you think about the character of Xuan, it's very, his character is very, like, one-dimensional, you know? If he doesn't have depth that you need to really fall in love with that character either. And, I mean, in the second, when you get to the sequel, he kind of, they completely write him off, obviously. But it kind of shows you the future that is in store because, you know, like, the stories are interesting. Like, when you look at the first and the second, we're going to get to the second, obviously. But when you look at it, the two movies is like a frame. It frames that section of life where a lot of Chinese people already know because of TV series. The part where, you know, because I don't know if you've ever watched a movie or watched a TV series of White Snake, but basically what it's about is that it's about Blanca, which we're going to use that name because it pertains to this movie. So basically the Blanca is she falls into this, like, you know, into like her own spirit realm. And then eventually she comes back out. And that's how you ended this movie, is that she meets him on a bridge. And that's like an iconic scene of how she meets him again. But we never knew that she had a relationship with him before. That's what the series is about. It's like her giving up her spirituality as a snake to be with a human. And then like this causes a lot of conflict between her and Verta. And that's basically what the TV series is always about. Obviously there's more to it, but you know, when you see this, you kind of see like this framework of the first movie and the second movie is completely like their imagination, in my mind at least.
Certainly when it comes to the villain side of the piece, I think that it seemed to have the same sort of promise of like Ninja Scroll, where we're going to have like a bunch of really interesting villains, but we basically just had the Dark General, who has Taoist powers, and at the same time he's also got his lieutenant who rides around on this beast which has got three heron heads on it, which is kind of cool. How he's dispatched is just comical, but I think that's more just an animation issue than anything else. It just has a big statue dropped off in it, and it's so comical. It's just like brat. And it's like you're expecting like some sort of comeback, but no, he's dead. That's it. It just seems a little simple, especially in like the build up where it was like all everyone started throwing magical powers around and stuff. It was kind of exciting for a minute. So to have a sudden ending like that, it's like oh okay. We also get a fox demon who is the greatest character in all of this world.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because the fox spirit, I remember when it first came out at the film festival, and I had talked to other people, and I think that was one of the most argumentative things in this film, is that a lot of people felt it was just such a typical over-the-top character that they didn't really like her. Whereas I thought it was a very unique character. I thought it really, like, worked in the realm. It added a little bit of, like, you know, sarcastic humor, a little bit of, you know, fun time, like a nice vibe type of thing, and I really thought it was a nice addition for a character.
Definitely, I think if any aspect of her character is over the top, is the fact that she has two minion-esque minions, who basically look like a pair of giant heads, but it later turns out that those are just masks that worn by the demons that hide within the robes. So, but I like her character. I think it's just really exciting. The fact she's got a fox mask on her, on the back of her head, and she can twist her head around.
So well, what it is she's a fox spirit. They're playing on the fact that, you know, fox spirit is a really big thing in Chinese folklore, yeah, mythology type of thing. So obviously the fox spirit is representative of the fact that she's like this sexy, seductive character, but with a very sly nature, you know? And that is what a fox spirit is known for in Chinese folklore and mythology. So it's very, like, to the character, but the way they design her is so nice, and the way she talks, and just her movements. I think that it's probably one of the characters with so much depth, and that is why I think that, you know, she also acts as this, you know, this, like, bridge between the two movies. Because basically you realize that she has no limits. Like, she has no dimensions. She lives in all dimensions, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, obviously, Fox Spirits before in various other films. Never seen one which is, like, the two sides in one person. It's normally, as I said, that they have the attractive female side, and they suffer a loss of power, that they start reverting more into their fox side. So the fact that she's got the fox mask on her back, and that she just, like, can use both at the same time, so you see her, like, inhale on her pipe, which is incredibly long, and then she exhale on the back, she twists her head right round. It's just such a cool visual, and her whole workshop setup as well is really exciting as well. The fact that it's just so built on magic and mythos, the fact that she's got all these, like, flying boxes that act as portals to other bits and pieces. So
yeah, it's interesting, because when you look at things like that, I think that in her realm, you really see a lot of Miyazaki inspirations. Like the wall of boxes, right? Isn't that like Spirited Away?
Yeah.
In the boiler room? And then you have the heads, and isn't that like Howl's movie? It's also Spirited Away. You have the heads, the heads from the mama.
Yeah, there's a lot of Spirited Away. I mean, there's even a demon bus driver in Green Snake that reminds us of the boiler room guy from Spirited Away. So as soon as I saw him, and I think there's even like those paper bird things. I can't remember if it's in this one or if it's in Green Snake.
It's the first one.
So it's
the first
one. It's kind of surprising the
amount. The Dark General's army is a paper.
Right,
paper army type of thing. Yeah,
yeah. It was just kind of interesting, the fact the amount of things that Miyazaki has obviously borrowed and carried across, because they're not things that we've sort of recognized in Japanese mythology before, and they're definitely more Chinese in mythology, and as we see here, they fit perfectly within this world. So it's kind of fun when you compare the two. And I think even if you don't know the mythology of this story, I think it's still very accessible.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Although, as I said, that I just no matter what I do, I just can't get past that crappy love story in here. And I think the fact it's balanced out by having like Werther come along, who's sort of like the hard-headed, rough and ready sort of sister, compared to Blanca, who's obviously the more delicate flower. But the two, when you put those two sisters together, it's some really exciting sequences, especially when we get into like the big finale where everyone's sort of like throwing magic around, and the lane sees the snake catcher village. I thought these were all like really exciting parts to it. Even like the hints of like the snake demon town that's under the waterfall, which the two sisters obviously belong to, I thought was also really interesting, but it was a little underexplored, it felt. So well, there's obviously things on a visual level that are really nice in this film, but there are other detractions from it. So I think, as I said, once it became just more about the two sisters fighting this dark general, and the more they pushed this one out of the picture, I think the more enjoyment I got out of it. So even though he's kind of a key part, so you can't like push him out completely.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like, I've noticed a lot more flaws this time, but I still think it's not too bad. I mean, would you have wanted a longer story just to pad out everything, right? I think that, you know, they had to include his character because it's part of the...
Yeah, it's kind of a key element, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of a key element. They did create this character, but they needed that male counterpart to, you know, kind of link to the story that everyone knows. I just thought it was, like, really... It's just very fast-paced. Like, they don't really give it a lot of time. You know, like, oh, day one, we met. And then day two, you know, we're making out in this thing where someone's about to, some general's assistant is going to start attacking us, yeah. You know? So it's very, like, it doesn't make a lot of sense, especially, you know, when you're talking about, like, ancient China.
Well, when Zwan turns himself into a demon, and she's like, "Oh, you'll be the lowest level demon." I really expect him to be like one of those minion types. I just didn't expect, "Oh, you're gonna be the same person, but you have your dog's tail."
Well, no, because I mean, it's like all of the spirits here. They retain a part of their human nature. But, you know, for him, it's kind of like a shortcut, because when you have a demon in these sort of mythologies, it's supposed to be like you're supposed to take like thousands and millions of years, lifetimes in order to build up enough, you know, power in you to transform into a human. But he got the shortcut. He got to be a human right away because of, you know, his exchange. So he had the tail and you know, it just felt a little like that whole transformation felt a little goofy though, because it was like they were like, oh yeah, you know, I'm gonna transform you, but we're still missing one thing, you know, and then it was like a tease and then you see him walk out and then he has Dudo's tail, so it was it's a little weird. As a final point though, I mean, if like I watched this one first time in Chinese, in Mandarin, and then I watched it because I now own the movie, but it's in English. I don't have the Chinese version. I actually think the Mandarin version is superior in voice acting.
Okay.
Yeah, so same applies, I think, to the second one. That's why the second one on Netflix is great, because you get to watch it in its original Mandarin language, which was fantastic.
Stephanie Shang voices Blanca in this one, who's in Eureka 7. She was Katana in DC Superhero Girls. She was Yuri in Sword Art Online. So she's done a whole bunch of stuff. So if you watch a lot of anime, then you'll probably be familiar with her. She was did like Samurai Champloo and the Sailor Moon. She's also Nui in Killer Kill, which is fantastic.
Well, obviously, I don't know any of the voice actors here. Okay. So it was all like, I just thought it was done really well.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought in general it was done really well. So
So that was White Snake. Should we talk about Green Snake now? So following on from White Snake, we had Green Snake, which was dumped onto Netflix with no indication that it was a sequel at all. So a lot of people on Letterboxd seem to be really confused the fact that this was a sequel.
Oh really? I knew it was a sequel.
Oh,
okay,
good for you, Kim. In China it's known as White Snake 2: The Tribulation of Green Snake, and was released in 2021. This one, I have to say, is a real step up in terms of the animation. It's a lot more ambitious, certainly when we have like a lot of the movement sequences. And the character designs seem less doll-like. I didn't find them so distracting, or perhaps it was the fact I was watching this one pretty much directly after White Snake that I'd grown more used to it. But this time we open up with Blanca and Werther, who are taking on the demon-slaying monk Fahai. Because they're trying to rescue Blanca's husband, Zhu Xian. And Blanca ends up getting captured in the monk's magic. And in turn, Werther also manages to get sucked into the same portal. We're finding herself waking up in a modern dystopian city called Assyriaville. which imprisons creatures from various eras, and soon find herself in a caught in a battle between the Oxheads and the Horsefaces, with the Ox leader seeking to conquer the city. This one's long, isn't it, Kim?
Yeah,
it's 2.5 hours.
It's you know, the deal is that I actually, for this one, I cut it up. I didn't watch it all in one sitting.
Okay.
So it didn't feel as long. I actually thought it was paced maybe even better than the first one. But it's just because there's always something going on. You always feel like it's always moving. There's always a threat. There's always something going on. And they're always moving. That it feels a little bit more like a fuller story, because now we're not focusing on, you know, romance. It's just basically their main goal is to find Blanca, escape the city and find Blanca, right? Or, you know, and eventually, obviously, she realizes there's a few more things she needs to do before she can actually escape.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when she first saw Atlantis City, she's introduced to a woman named Sun, who basically helps her adjust to this world where she doesn't have any of her demon powers. And it's this real sort of Mad Max style situation with these two gangs basically trying to attack each other constantly, while at the same time the city has its own huge demons that reset everything and basically plunge the city into an apocalyptic wasteland, only to rebuild itself every day. And if you weren't sure what audience this was for, this is definitely an adult one, because people were getting killed left, right and center in various horrible ways. I mean, the character's son gets bumped off pretty early, spoiler alert, which I was kind of shocked at, because I kind of really liked her character.
Yeah, no, I really liked their character, too. I was surprised she got bumped so quickly, but it felt like because the movie ran so long and she met so many people that it felt like the turnover of characters being her companion was pretty quick.
She also gets smitten with a guy named Simon, and there's also a mysterious masked man who helps her on her journey as well. I was really into this one, and then we got to like the last hour, and then it just seemed to all fall apart for me, which is a real shame, because I was really enjoying it up to that point.
The last part was all about like her having like this kind of romance relationship with a masked man. That's when it falls apart. Every time we get a romance, it's like, nope.
It just got overly complex.
No. Just teasing you, but I mean, no. I mean, the movie runs that way. I actually didn't. I actually, maybe because this is like fresh, I actually got very invested at the end. Like, the ending is also a little bit like, a bittersweet ending, like the first one type of thing.
Yeah.
And for me, I actually got a bit misty. So I was, it was interesting. I actually didn't have any issues with this one. I was surprised. I was going into this one being a little bit skeptical, because I didn't really feel like the first movie needed a sequel. And then to have Netflix release the sequel was also a little worrying. Because, I don't know, Netflix hasn't been on, like, Netflix is like a very, like, the random movie that's very, very good choice, and then there's a lot of movies that are, like, not really great. So I was a little bit worried about how this one would pan out and what angle they would take, and I remember, and I went into this one completely blind. I had no idea that it was going to be more of a dystopian world and that sort of thing, and I think it worked into its favor, because they were able to do, like, a billion montages of like, oh, her learning how to adapt into this world and drive a car and use a gun and stuff like that. Just a lot of montages of her doing stuff to kind of like bridge over the things. But I mean, imagine if they didn't, the movie would be like 3 hours long.
Yeah, it was, but this whole setup was great. I mean, as I said, I really liked, it's sort of like if you want Mad Max, but with like yokai monsters.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. And there's a really exciting sort of chase sequence that they have as well. And of course, if that wasn't enough for you, we also get the return of the fox demon, which is known as Foxy Boss, if you use the X-ray function on Amazon Prime. Yeah, don't trust Amazon Prime for, like, getting you all the character names. They seem to just be making them up. But yes, the greatest character of this series returns. And gets a little bit of a character redesign. She's a little got more of a modern look in this one, which is rather fitting because of the world that they're in. It's this sort of modern world, even though these characters are from various different eras. And I think that's the other thing, which for a lot of people, the fact it goes from, like, ancient China and then suddenly we're, like, in modern day. I think that for a lot of people. So, but I think it really worked for the story that they're telling here.
Look, most people at this point has watched Everything Everywhere All at Once. Dimension changes should not be an issue. Okay, I'm just gonna say it right now. Like, I think that it's fine. In a movie like this, you're basically justifying, they've already justified that this world is kind of like an in-between world. Kind of like an in-between world because, well, it's kind of like this fantasy world that this Fahai has created for all these spirits that shouldn't be, you know, who's had stuff that's, you know, basically unfinished business. So it's kind of like an in-between world. It's interesting because, you know, like, this world feels like it's built by this guy. And then all of a sudden, how is the fox spirit there? And how does the whole world work, right? There's, like, a portal and there's all these, like, dimensions and all that stuff. And I think it's an interesting take. Like, you have this, like, futuristic kind of dystopian, and then you have, like, all these characters. It's like someone was, like, just toss everything together and have fun, you know, type of thing. And it's interesting. I think that it's a really fun approach because now you have all these mediums, all these, like, avenues to create conflict, create kind of, like, oh, you know, like, you know, and you can actually see, like, kind of, like, a reflection of the world. There's, like, someone who wants to unite everyone together, and there's one who wants to be, like, oh, you know, it's supposed to be only us creatures that are here. And then there's supposed to be, oh, this world is not supposed to exist, you know, like, humans are not supposed to be in this world type of thing, you know? You're supposed to have died. So there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of deeper elements to why this world exists, and what everyone is trying to do. And I think that when you look at this, you can see the experience of the studio itself has kind of increased because now you're looking at, this is the second film that the writer of the thing is Damao. And basically you can see that this person has basically added, they've kind of grown in their writing. All these characters are more vivid. There's a lot more depth to it. When you look at Verda, she has more depth. When you look at, you know, there's a lot more backstory. And then you see all these different characters also have their stories because now you're talking about, you know, you're in this in-between world and you have this, everyone's there because they don't, you know, they have something that they're holding on that they're not ready to die yet and reincarnate. So you have this kind of, like, unfinished business, and you see these images show up. I don't really think everybody's thing needed to be seen, but we spent a great sequence just, like, watching everyone's sequence of, you know, like, oh, what they couldn't let go of and blah, 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 you know, and that was a bit, you know, like, some of the parts needed a bit of editing. It felt like you didn't need everything there in order to pad it out. There was definitely some things that could have been edited out to create a more tighter experience, and it wouldn't have made a huge difference.
Yeah, and also we have this really awesome set where you've got, like, as I said, you've got the Oxhead gangs and the horse faces, and you've got all these really interesting characters within that gang. You've got, like, harpies, and you've got, like, impish sort of characters, and then they're all pretty much wiped out once we get to the Fox Spirit Market, and it just basically becomes about Simon the Mass Man and Verta. And it sort of felt like it was doing itself a disservice that you were moving all these really interesting looking characters, and instead we just have, like, these three humanoid characters.
I don't know. I mean, I don't have a big issue with it because I actually thought the character designs for them were pretty good. Maybe it's a very... You're talking about Kingdom Hearts in the first one, and I actually thought Kingdom Hearts actually applies to this one for a lot of the costume designs. It felt like there was some real inspiration with, like, I don't know, Final Fantasy and Kingdom Hearts with a lot of the characters, especially, like, Simon and... there's a lot of inspiration. I don't know. Maybe that's the thing, but... I don't know. It was just, I don't really think that the ox people, like, they had their part. I think that they needed to take them out so that you would be able to kind of be like, okay, well, the fox spirit, that whole segment would kind of shed light on you know, the purpose of these people. Why are they doing all this? Why are they doing it more frequently? You know, like, there has to be a reason to it. And they're kind of, like, adding these little bits in to make it make sense, to kind of, like, pull out. Then they get some other story to fill in, right?
Yeah, and I think there's a really great sequence where you've got the Ox Army that are attacking the Fox Spirit's castle.
Yeah.
And they're coming by water, and I thought it was such a great sequence. Just how it was all set up, and kind of reminded me of For Honor in a way. Just when you see, like, when you see it, and you've got when they raise up, like, the metal fence, and they've got their, they're trying to stop them cutting through it. It was just a really great put together sort of sequence. And the Ox, as I said, the leader of the Ox Gang himself is an interesting sort of, like, big hulking sort of figure that is sort of immortal from suffering from from any sort of effects of this world. And we obviously find out the reason why is the film sort of goes on. And we also get, like, that Doctor Strange sort of sequence where Verti is going back to fight the monk, and it's sort of like takes 20 years in the human world, but it's only taking a day in the world that they're in. So that was kind of fun, the fact that she's, like, constantly going back, and she, every time she gets defeated, she's, like, flung back, and then she just goes back in again. And
and you see the world that she's in is deteriorating as well, and it's crazy, because every time she flies back out, there's, like, panels coming off, fire shooting in, and there's, like, all these because the world they're in is, like, is always, like, inundated by, like, different catastrophes, right?
Yeah, different, I mean, we threats. Have, like, these big demons that appear. We've got, like, a big fire Rodan. We've got a giant turtle that causes floods. So
yeah,
I'm always interested when you have, like, big kaiju type monsters rolling in and resetting everything. And at the same time, you have, like, buildings that spring up out of the crumbling rubble, and that sort of dark city vibe as well is pretty damn cool as well. It's just once we get into the last hour, and it's sort of like, okay, well, we got to get our way to this bridge. We could take the shortcut and give up something of ourselves, or we can, like, just take this bridge, which nobody's bothered to tell us about for the first hour and a half of this film. But we're gonna go to this bridge for the last hour, and it just, for myself, it just really dragged. I just was so checked out at that point.
It was because, I mean, I think that when you talk about, like, it's kind of very in the Fox Spirit character, right? Because she knows that she's the only person, basically, that knows about this thing that happens at one specific time of the day. And I think that it matches to her character because, like, the first time you go, she wants you to trade in her your stuff, you know? She wants you to trade in, and then you just fade away, right? So that she doesn't have to, you know, actually exchange something. She's just taking your life.
Yeah,
she's just taking your thing for fuel. And then, but then, you know, when you get to the end, you realize that she's taking all these things because of, you know, what she needs to fuel whatever world she's doing. But at the same time, she also knows this alternate way to leave. And because of that, you get to go another path, and then you get to do this whole thing that they have to do to go there. But obviously, this whole sequence was to lead up to the big finale, right? The big finale of whether they were going to escape and get out of the world, and to figure out who this masked man is, because obviously he's got to have a purpose there. He's not just going to be masked the entire time. I do appreciate the movie for all this stuff. I don't have it's the first time, maybe because I split it up in parts, that I didn't really feel the length as much. I get what you're saying, though. Like, would it have been more efficient if she just said it the first time? I mean, it would cut all the crap about all that stuff about, like, oh, what you're holding on to, because basically we already know what Verta is holding on to. Like, do we really need to know what she's holding on to? Not really.
Apparently she needs to be told what she's holding on to.
But I think the whole sequence was to give the foundation for, like, the masked man, kind of give him, like, that stepping stone into how the story expands. Because if you don't have that part, then you don't really have that finale where you finally see, like, you know, he finally starts to see what it is that he forgot, what it is that he's holding on to.
That whole masked man sequence just annoyed me something rather than it. So, like, I'm just going to say spoiler alert here. The fact that we had the big reveal, and it's revealed that it's Blanka.
And, as a dude?
Yeah, as a dude, I know. And then the Ox King turns up and is like, no, this is just a mask. He's impersonating your sister. And it's like, okay, fine. So then we get, he carries on. And then suddenly it's sort of like, it almost feels like that they couldn't be bothered to come up with a reasonable explanation for this, to give her to what she's been searching for. So they're sort of like, no, it was Blank all along. And it's like, well, either it is or it isn't.
I mean, they do explain it pretty well. I'm going to defend the movie here.
I'm glad you're able to defend it, because I was so annoyed with it.
Because I don't think, because when you go to the final ending and she picks up that piece, she gets back into the modern world, obviously. And then I don't know why, but she's back into the modern world. And she's in the museum, and then she realizes that the piece that they've been holding on to the whole time from this masked man character is actually the missing piece for her pendant thing, her hairpin, her magical hairpin. Yeah. And obviously we didn't talk about the magical hairpin ever before, but that exists. And this all comes together afterwards, because you start seeing, like, she starts understanding that this whole time what he's saying is all this stuff. And obviously, because we've watched 2 hours of this movie, we forgot in the beginning that the dialogue was what it was when he was pulling away. Like, oh, it was that day. I don't remember that. It was from the first sentence in the movie. I don't remember it. It was just like, I think that it is, like, I personally appreciated it, because I like movies that do this, like, front and back connection thing. So it got me very, like, into it, and plus I was really, like, moved by the whole scene of them having to separate and fade away. So when this all came together, it was kind of like, oh no, like, you were like, because they have to find some way to make this character come back, and you were like, oh, but is he really gone? Is he gonna find him? Like, is the spirit gonna somehow be somewhere, And then when you get to that last scene where she's like, oh, everything's piecing together, and she's finally understanding all this is going on, then you really, like, there's, like, this really appreciation of how they bring this character back. And I'm really excited about that. But I think that, the best part is for you, probably. I don't know. Did you watch the end credits?
Yeah, I watched the end credits.
Yeah. Okay, you watched the end credits, right? Because the end credits, I mean, seems like it's hinting towards a third movie. And that third movie is going to be with your favorite character, right? So that's something to be excited about.
Well, this is, I'm not sure where it, what's going on there, because we have that. And then we go into, I think it's the Yang Jian setup.
Mm-hmm.
Which was obviously the production which followed. And itself is a prequel to New Gods Nisa Reborn.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure which one I'm supposed to watch first. Am I supposed to watch Nisa Reborn or?
You watch Nisa and then you watch Nisa Reborn.
Right, thank you.
That's how they were released. They were released, that one and then the other one next. Because, that was the other choice I had for this pairing,
Right. This is. So we have this interesting little steampunk setup at the end, and we obviously see the fox spirit doing deals with an underwater demon. So she's saying she's going to have her revenge, and it's got the tail. I'm not sure where that's going to go, but
I really think it's just that they're done with this Blanka Verda story now. So they're going to jump next to the fox spirit and give her a story, a justification. Like, give her a story, basically. Like, someone cut off one of her 9 tails or something. And now she wants it. Now she has revenge, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because I would have to brush up on my fox spirit mythology. Like, folklore first. Folktale.
I'm just trying to place one of these spirits, and that is, because I'm sure there's a Japanese one as well. But
fox spirit, we saw a story in Love, Death, and Robots, I think.
Of course we did, yes.
Yeah, and that one was pretty, I thought that one was pretty, like, a good take on that, whole fox spirit thing, I remember.
Because that was in the steampunk city.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember now. I need to really go back and rewatch all Love, Death, and Robots again now. Maybe a good palate cleanser after this. It's a cautious recommendation for myself. What about you, Kim? Are you giving this a bigger recommendation?
I'm giving it a bigger recommendation. I think it's really worth it. I mean, I've had my eyes on, like, China cinema, like mainland China cinema, for a while. So this is definitely something that really stands out in, you know, the limited amount of films that I've been able to catch. I think that it's a really good effort, because when you're talking about, you know, I think everything has a starting point. And this is a really great take because, you know, they're taking their own folklore, their own, you know, their own stories and kind of showing the world a different take of it. So it kind of intrigues you into maybe a new, you know, folklore and mythology and understanding a little more about the culture as well. You know, we didn't talk about the music or anything, but I really think the music and soundtrack was really great also. And visuals, and it's something that I think you don't expect, because I feel like when you look at, like, Chinese movies, a lot of times you just think about it's all like set in, like, real like the reality. It's not really animated as much, and there's just so much to offer in this one. Maybe, like, the romance is not, you know, up to par, but personally for me, I thought it was pretty decent. So, I mean, I definitely recommend the both. I think both of them are something that you should at least watch once.
If you want to obviously watch these, Whitesnake is available on Amazon Prime, whereas Greensnake is available on Netflix. So they should be able to, both should be easy to get hold of there. But that brings us into tonight's episode. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you haven't done already, please do check our blog, which is moviesandteapodcast.wordpress.com. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Say hi to us there. And wherever you happen to listen to us, please do hit the like and subscribe button. Leave us a review, as it all helps raise the profile of the show. But next time, it is my turn to choose. And we're going to be looking at something from the A24 catalogue, which seems all the more fitting now, seeing as how they had a big win at the Oscars this year. But we're going to an earlier film in their catalogue as we look at It Comes at Night. So, Jake, should you join us for that? And until next time, thank you for listening. Thank you to my co-host, Kim. And we'll be back next time to talk about It Comes at Night. But until then, good night. Mm-hmm.